Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
That's why I say it annoys me so much, because he can, when he wants to do it, can be as happy a stylist as we've had in the last 50 or 75 years. By the way, now that you've mentioned Faulkner, I would name one other man who could have been one of our great stylists, and you just didn't bother at all, and that's Thomas Wolfe. And he just had a perfect fountain of words just flow out. It would have been as lovely as this little stretch. I don't mean lovely in the sense of sentimental or anything of that sort. He had power in his prose occasionally, and so Faulkner's going to be. With our democratic system of education, the crowded curriculum and the glorification of fact, and the hurry that thwarts reflection, the average college student has far fewer words at his disposal and his reach than had the educated men of the 17th or even the late 19th century. Consequently, we lack the vocabulary. You know these words if you read them, but you rarely read them nowadays. Somebody was asking me the other day how many words are in the vocabulary of the average man. My guess is that you would probably, the average one of you, would use somewhere around 10,000. That you would know, if you're really intelligent and perceptive, you would know around 30,000. But the tendency is to use fewer and fewer words. We're in a hurry. We don't have time. We don't reflect. Few people are interested in rhetoric. Few people know anything about rhetoric, and so the vocabulary shrinks. Lacking the vocabulary, and with little emphasis on style, we say what we have to say with a blurred vagueness. The 20th century, then, has seen a great retreat from the power of the word. The major energies of the modern mind are directed toward other modes of language, and by the time I'd write a paper on this subject, symbolism, for example, in the natural sciences and mathematics, and especially the use of pictures. Think of how many picture magazines we actually have, and all we've got to read there is a caption. And then television, of course, communicates to us without even any written word at all. And the picture is practically the whole thing. Comic books. Our culture lives really by the picture rather than the words. I could go on with that, but now I'm going to make remarks on the other side. It's worth noting that Southern writing reveals much more awareness of style than that of any other section of the country. And more specifically, I'd suggest that our Southern women tend to be outstanding stylists. I should rank Catherine Ann Porter and Carson McCullers and Eudora Welty, Flannery O'Connor, Shirley Ann Grau, and Elizabeth Spencer in the last 10 years as being outstanding stylists. When I had written that much in my notes, then I raised the question to myself, well, why should this be? And I suggest tentatively these reasons. The first one is Southern familiarity with the Bible. We go to church very often, more, I think, than in any other part of the country, and we hear the Bible read constantly in church, and often still in the house, in the home. And there can be no better textbook for superb rhetoric than the King James Version of the Bible. I recommend it to you, not as a religious person, but as one interested in rhetoric. That's one reason I think Southerners tend to have a sense of style. A second is the survival of talk and conversation in the South as one of the amenities of life. By the way, Bryden, that's where I would certainly give Faulkner high marks, because in conversation, when he reports conversation, you're almost there yourself frequently. This is a long paragraph, so I object to, but I say talk and conversation flourish in the South as they rarely do anywhere else. Still considered a part of good upbringing in many parts of the South, trained daughters particularly to be able to carry on a conversation under any circumstances. I must tell you about an experience I had when I first came to Washington. They, one of the dowagers in town, who should be nameless, told me about an experience that she had with her mother when she Dowager was the little girl. The mother called the three daughters into the room and said, "Now, I'm going to be a visitor, and I'm coming to call on you, and you are to entertain me." So she came in the room, the three daughters started off beautifully. They talked about the weather, and they talked about the party that they'd been to the night before, and one thing and another. And then this mother saying, "Yes, well, how interesting, no, or whatever was required of it," but not making any contribution to the conversation at all. And it was left entirely up to the daughters, you see, to carry on the conversation, to think of the next thing to talk about, and to keep it going. And after about 5 minutes of this, they were just in utter despair. And said, "Mother, you've just got to help us out." And she said, "Not at all. You're going to face this problem all the way through your life now. So learn to carry on the conversation." And I think I say that Southern women, more than Southern men, do know how to keep the conversation involved going, are more aware, therefore, of the nuances of words, of language, of tone of voice, of rhythm, of what is monotonous in other people, and therefore in their own style. Not even the gabble of the cocktail party has yet destroyed this tradition in the South. One other reason I would suggest is that Southerners tend not to discuss abstract issues. They seem generally to prefer to tell stories and to give concrete cases. I wish all of you could have known Dr. Gaines. My office was on right across the hall from him, and he had a habit of just barging in at any time, interrupting what I was doing, but almost always just to chat, to pass the time of the day, or tell me the latest story, and sometimes the latest half dozen stories that he had, and he was a consummate storyteller. Now that's in the good old Southern tradition, and it again makes everybody aware of what is an effective story, what makes a story effective, what makes a story fall flat, though it may be told in exactly the same general words. So that those are the only reasons that I can think of why Southerners, more than most other Americans, are stylists. Would any of you like to nominate other American writers as stylists?
Sir Justin, Miss St. Junior.
Well, I'm talking about now, down in the United States. Yes, down in the United States right now. Authors writing at this present time. As I say, the two great disappointments to me are Thomas Wolfe and William Faulkner, because they had all the possibilities. They could have been beautiful scholars, you know, they put their minds to it. All the nominations. Our presidents of the United States offer perfect examples for any study of rhetoric. Two of them stand out as monumental misusers of the language. You know who one of them is. The other is Warren Gamaliel Harding. Three of them rank with the most percipient of prose stylists in the history of the English language, in my opinion. Jefferson, Lincoln, and Wilson. I'll not comment on Jefferson and Wilson, but Lincoln is probably the subtlest of them all. And this is the more remarkable because I noted the other day he had no formal education. I'd like to read you a passage written by him when he was only 33 to a friend who was melancholy. My guess is that he had the slightest notion of anything that we've said about rhetoric, but he had so trained his ear, and therefore his pen, that the rhetoric was just perfect. This friend of his was melancholy, and Lincoln is, in this letter to him, is analyzing the causes of melancholy. The second cause, he says, is the absence of all business and conversation of friends, which might divert your mind and give it occasional rest from that intensity of thought which will sometimes wear the sweetest idea threadbare and turn it to the bitterness of death. Now, the final phrases in that sentence are rhetorically perfect. The balance of vowels and consonants, the assonance and alliteration, the progression, listen to the subtleties, the progression from the long E's, sweetest idea, over which one would really want to linger, to the short and closed vowels of the bitterness of death, which chill the lyrical rhythm and bite it off at the end. on that show to the training of the literary ear, which certainly is not often taught in our modern schools. Let me read that sentence again. The second cause of melancholy is the absence of all business and conversation with friends, which might divert your mind and give it occasional rest from that intensity of thought, which will sometimes wear the sweetest idea threadbare and turn it to the bitterness of death. It may very well be that Mr. Kennedy will take his place beside these other three. His one inaugural address was a masterpiece of rhetoric. It was rich in its use of figures of speech. I wish I had time to go into that in some detail. Metaphor, antithesis, personification, anaphora, paranomasia, for example, all those just are there. In these recent discussions of rhetoric, we may seem at times to have wandered far from the Greeks and Romans who constitute the principal subject matter of this course. And yet rhetoric, with all of its richness and subtlety, all of the treasures of language it opens to us, is simply one more heritage we owe to these classical authors. It was they who discovered the art of rhetoric, practiced it themselves, passed it on to us for the enrichment of our lives. It's the final topic we shall be able to discuss in this course. It's by no manner of means the final contribution they made to the literature of later ages. In one semester, we can call attention only to several of the outstanding gifts they've given us. By the way, the great regret I have about this course is that it couldn't go on. I've got a stack of notes this high of things that I just regret not having been able to discuss. The whole Plutarch, for example, just left completely, and various other authors to whom I paid no attention. On this matter of rhetoric, I suggest, as a hobby, not only that you learn about the devices of rhetoric and then go back to the classical authors and see how they use that, but as another possible hobby, undertake the compilation of a record of the literary influences of Greek and Latin authors on later ages. Your term papers were very good beginnings for that sort of a hobby. Now you know what the influence of the classics on Pope or on Spencer or on Milton or whoever else actually were. So why not keep that in the back of your mind and pursue it, as I say, as a hobby for the rest of your life. The passing years make me more and more grateful to these men who, from Homer downward, poured out their riches on us. One of the things that I would have liked to do at the end of this course is just to skim through the whole of my reading for the last 20 years or so in the matter of the classics, just odds and ends of items that I've picked up here and there, or things that I've thought about that there isn't time enough to discuss in this course. Again, I've got stacks of notes on that thing. One topic, and I don't have time on it just barely to mention it. In the ancient history course, I make the generalization, and you've certainly heard it before, that our Western civilization is the result of the flowing together of three streams from the past, the Judeo-Christian, the Greek, and the Roman. And then we go in the history course into detail about what we derive from each of those streams. Well, now, leaving out for the moment any consideration or discussion of the Roman influence, I should advance the thesis that to the extent that we have taken in our civilization anything from Hellenic culture, there is then an essential, deep, and complete conflict in our culture. The Greek influence is in many ways antithetical to our Judeo-Christian influence. There is then, I say, an internal schism in our cultural heritage, and the conflict centers about religious ideas and our values, our ideals, our moral concepts. I think this schism began at the time of the Renaissance, or the contemporaneous movement. The Reformation was antithetical to everything that the Renaissance stood for. Just think of all the protests made since that time against the Hebrew Christian tradition that we have. And you see the division there is in our minds. Now, it's true that the schism and the conflict are apparent only to intellectuals, but for them, this tension has become, in the 20th century, almost unendurable. Just consider, throughout the major part of Greek history, there wasn't any feeling of a need for a personal deity, no need for a future life, nor any belief in a purely spiritual world. In the Hellenic period, the emphasis, remember, was on this world, in which men's highest devotion were given to the polis. So if we follow at all in this Greek way, how can we reconcile our admiration for the Greeks with what Judeo-Christianity teaches us? Well, once again, the Greeks had no sense of sin whatever, unless we interpret hubris as sin, and that was in a unique category. And the Greeks regarded their faults as merely being ones of bad taste. That word was hamartia. You missed the mark. Well, that's too bad. String up your bow and try again. And our idea of sin is entirely different. The moral code, the Ten Commandments, the insistence on sin are all just antithetical to anything that the Greeks would believe in. Again, our religion teaches us that we ought to be made over. You must be born again, a new man, if you're going to be a Christian. But you certainly know that that's, again, contrary to anything, the idea that would have been shocking to the Greeks. And so I say, up and down, we have this dichotomy, this conflict, this tension in our culture, and I see no way of reconciling. My time is almost up. This is a course in which I've never been able to make any kind of valedictory or farewell remarks at all. I hope I have been able in this course at least to share with you some of my enthusiasm, real enthusiasm for the classics of Greece and Rome. And I hope you'll have the light for the rest of your lives in living with the great men and women who, both real and imaginary, whom you've met in this course, and think of these people, Homer, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Virgil, Catullus, Achilles, Odysseus, Oedipus, Prometheus, Aeneas, the real ones, I say, as well as the imaginary ones. And I hope that all through your life, you'll read the classics with increasing enjoyment. They're a never-ending source of pleasure. Wish you well on the examination. I suppose there's only one proper valediction in the course in the classics. That would be Catullus, Sabe, Atque, Wale, Hail, and Farewell. Thank you.